Tehran says the outcome of the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA hinges on a political decision by Washington. Israeli forces kill a Palestinian teenager in the West Bank city of Jenin as tensions remain high in a flashpoint neighborhood of the occupied Al-Quds. Iranian top Sheikh Larik and the main opposition group Al-Wafaq condemned the appointment of a naval Israeli officer to be stationed in the country. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, Iran's top security official says that the fate of the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA, has come down to a political decision by the U.S., obviating the need for speculations. In a Twitter post, Ali Shamkhani said the negotiations have reached a stage which does not require guesswork, and the result cannot be definitively declared. He said that the U.S. must decide whether it will embrace or refuse to accept the requirements for a reliable and durable agreement based on principles agreed to in the JCPOA. Now, the comments came as Iran and the other remaining parties to the accord are engaged in diplomatic efforts in Vienna to restore it, which was battered by the U.S. unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman says the country is awaiting a political decision by the Western side.
Currently going on in Vienna are discussions about very important, sensitive, outstanding issues. This is no secret to anyone. What remains is to reach a point where political decisions should be made. Tehran has already made its political decisions years ago and remained inside the JCPOA. Iran is now waiting to receive the response to its initiatives from the Western side in particular.
Now, the spokesman says that currently there is no deadlock in the talks and negotiations will inevitably slow down as more serious issues are discussed and tougher decisions are required. The spokesman stressed that there is an inverse correlation between the will and resolve of the Western side and the time required to reach an agreement. Said Khatibzadeh says that all anti-Iran sanctions at odds with the JCPOA and Resolution 2231, which enshrines the deal, must be removed, regardless of the label under which they have been imposed. So from Vienna, let's bring in our correspondent, Homar Lesge, there. Homar, good to have you with us. So what's going on there? Bring us an update.
Yes, as you said there, the talks aimed at restoring the JCPOA are still ongoing. Yesterday, although it was a Sunday, meetings were taking place intensively, a lot of discussions. As far as the Iranians were concerned, there was a meeting between the head of Iran's delegation and his team, Mr. Ali Bagherikani, and the Russian side, led by Mikhail Oryanov, separately. There were meetings between the 4 plus 1 and the U.S., Russia and the U.S., Russia and the E3, etc. So a lot of diplomatic activity as efforts intensified to come to a conclusion. Now, there were some reports last night circulating that we might see soon, even today, Monday, a joint commission session, but these were not confirmed, we heard, and it's up to the decision that the participants here make. But of course, we were also told that any format of the discussions, whether it's bilateral, trilateral, multilateral, whether it's in the context of the Joint Commission between all the participants of the Joint Commission, that would be minus the US, this would be based on the requirements and needs of the negotiators, and this would be a decision that would be up to them. Up until this stage, they haven't decided, or it hasn't been officially announced, that they would like to go ahead with the Joint Commission session, and these negotiations are continuing at various formats. Now, it's, as far as we're learning from sources close to the Iranians, is that after this break that we had in the eighth round, the sides went back to their capitals and came back. Proposals in the form of written exchanges have been conveyed between the sides. Iranians have come with some proposals, we're hearing, on the remaining issues, with the new initiatives on how to deal with them. And the other sides have also come with their own proposals. And they're kind of hammering it out here around the negotiating table. What the Iranians have been saying is that if the other side gives a positive response to the proposals or initiatives put forward by the Iranian side, then an agreement will be possible, not by the end of February, but even tomorrow. So it's that's why they say it's up to particularly the U.S. to make that political decision. And as I was saying earlier, some sources have been saying or claiming that the Russians and the Chinese and even the Europeans are quite frustrated with the fact that the American team is not giving a firm response to these proposals or coming up with the decision that it needs to come up with. And this is seen as a sign of differences within the U.S. negotiating team itself, or also, of course, the pressure that the Biden administration faces from Republicans, from allies like Israel, etc. So these are all, of course, playing into the issue. What the Iranian sources say is that they are not here, as some Western media sources may claim, to prolong the negotiations, to drag things. They believe that an agreement is within sight. The Western side has said that they believe and a conclusion to these talks is also possible and within sight if the necessary decisions are made. The sticking points, of course, we know specifically on the scope of sanctions and the issue of verification and guarantees.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. Kumar Lezgi in Vienna. A fire has reportedly broken out at a support base of the Iranian armed forces in the western province of Kermanshah. According to reports, the fire, that's now extinguished, was limited to a stock room for engine oil and other inflammable material. No one was hurt in the incident at the base belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. An investigation is underway to determine the damage and the cause of the fire. A Venezuelan airline says it's ready to launch direct flights between Caracas and Tehran for tourists, business people, and industrialists. Canaviasa says the decision to start flights between the two capitals was made as both countries have handled the COVID pandemic well. The airline says the tourism industry is of significance to Venezuela. Dozens of Iranian and tour operators are scheduled to travel to Venezuela in early March to be briefed on tourist attractions of the Latin American country. This will be the first step toward starting commercial flights between the two countries. Israeli forces have pressed ahead with their atrocities against Palestinians. A teenager succumbed to his injuries sustained during an attack by the regime forces on the West Bank city of Jenin. 17-year-old Akram Abu Saleh was shot in the head. The teenager, along with hundreds of Palestinians, were protesting the regime's attempt to destroy a home in the West Bank. Parallel protests were also taking place in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the Akbar al-Quds. Israeli forces and extremist settlers viciously attacked and injured over 30 Palestinians there. Hamas resistance movement says the people of the whole occupied land stand by the Sheikh Jarrah protesters. Anger has grown among the Palestinians after a far-right Israeli lawmaker paid a visit to Sheikh Jarrah, where he opened an office. Last year, the neighborhood was highly tense over an Israeli plan to evict dozens of Palestinian families from their ancestral homes. Our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kendall joined us a short while ago and provided some details regarding the Israeli violence in Jenin and Al-Quds.
What happened is that Israeli forces with their armored vehicles and jeeps, tanks, raided the village of Silat al-Harithiya in order to destroy the home of a Palestinian prisoner, this Palestinian prisoner, Mohammed Jaradat, whom the Israeli authorities accuse that he carried out a shooting attack against Israeli settlers. The Israeli troops were intending to destroy his home. Clashes erupted between the Palestinians living in the village of Silat al-Harithiya and other villages around this town with the Israeli forces. They retreated back. However, in the early hours of this morning, Israeli troops returned to the village of Silat al-Harithiya and succeeded, unfortunately, to destroy the home of Jaradat, this Palestinian prisoner. Elsewhere in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, the situation is still tense, with Palestinians are still protesting the settlers' attacks, settlers' aggression, and they clashed together, the settlers and the residents of Sheikh Jarrah, and even the protesters who had been there. A number of Palestinians were wounded because at the end of the day, of course, Israeli forces attacked the Palestinians, protecting and giving the support to the Israeli settlers in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
A Bahraini top cleric has called on all Muslims to stand against any compromise with the Israeli regime and its expansionism. Sheikh Isa Qasim says the Muslim community has the responsibility of opposing Tel Aviv's oppressive policy. He slammed the deployment of a senior Israeli officer to Bahrain as another sign of Israeli colonialist measure. On Saturday, Manama confirmed the stationing of a high-ranking Israeli officer in Bahrain as part of an international coalition. The move was also criticized by Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wafaq. The group said that the ruling Al-Khalifa regime's decision for such an appointment was an attack on Bahrain's sovereignty. Al-Wafaq also questioned the popular legitimacy of the Bahraini regime, saying that Al-Khalifa is on a quest to obtain a, quote, fictitious power from the Zionists. Now, meantime, February 14th marks the 11th anniversary of an uprising in Bahrain, which has evolved to demand the ouster of the ruling Al-Khalifa regime. Opposition groups have called for mass rallies and online campaigns to commemorate the anniversary. We have more in this next report.
A popular uprising, better known as the Islamic Awakening, came to Bahrain a decade ago. On February the 14th, 2011, people of Bahrain staged a massive demonstration in the capital Manama. It was the beginning of a movement that plunged the autocratic Al-Khalifa regime into an unprecedented crisis. In the early days of protests, Manama's Pearl Roundabout was the symbol of the uprising. Tens of thousands of people gathered here to peacefully call for reforms. Protesters demanded a parliament with a popular mandate and a new constitution. The Bahraini regime was, however, quick to show its intolerant face to dissidents. Regime forces attacked the demonstrators, who firmly stood their ground. The brutal crackdown left many people dead as the police, in many occasions, fired live rounds directly at protesters. The heavy-handed attack led to protests increasing in size and intensity, with angry demonstrators calling for the downfall of the ruling family. The regime became incapable of withstanding increasing popular outrage, so 1 month into the protests, Manama authorized troops from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to enter the kingdom and help silence the voices of dissent with a harsher crackdown. Thousands of people were detained, including elected members of Bahrain's parliament. Many were tortured and killed in detention. The clampdown was rarely covered in Western mainstream media, and the Al-Khalifa regime didn't even get a slap on the wrist from the West for what it did to its own people. Critics say that's largely because the kingdom is a close American ally which hosts the United States Navy Fifth Fleet. Bahrain's uprising was suppressed, but did not die. Since 2011, anti-regime protests have been staged frequently in villages and towns across the tiny Persian Gulf kingdom. Scores of people have lost their lives, and hundreds of others have been injured over the past decade. Authorities also targeted thousands of religious and political figures and activists, among them opposition leader Sheikh Ali Salman, who was handed a life sentence, human rights activist Nabil Rajab, that was imprisoned, and Shia leader Sheikh Isa Qasim, whose nationality was stripped. The regime managed to forcefully contain the uprising without addressing the people's demands. But what is certain is that the public discontent hasn't gone away and is instead pushed below the surface for now.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signed an order allowing half of the $7 billion from Afghanistan's central bank reserves to be distributed among victims of the 9/11 attack. And that has sparked anger and criticism among the Afghan people. We have a report from Afghan capital Kabul.
Afghanistan, dealing with one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Poverty hits almost all of the families across the country, with more than 90% of Afghans living on $1 a day. Cash and food shortages are pushing millions to the brink of starvation.
Today, all Afghans are short of money and food. We cannot even afford loaves of bread for our families. There are no jobs and no money. We hope world countries send more humanitarian aid and free all our frozen assets so that we receive something to eat.
In such a dire situation in Afghanistan, the U.S. president has signed an order allowing half of the $7 billion in frozen assets from Afghanistan's central bank to be reserved for 9/11 victims. Afghans condemn the move as oppressive and call for the entire amount to be unfrozen for saving Afghan people's lives.
The U.S. is bullying our oppressed people. Distributing our assets among 9/11 victims is a clear theft. The world knows that no Afghan was involved in 9/11 attack. Even the attack was a game launched by the U.S. itself. We call on the international community to join our protests and make the U.S. reconsider its decision.
Our block assets are our rights. That is the money of poor and hungry Afghans. All of it should be spent for Afghanistan's relief and goods. You see the dire situation in Afghanistan. People are dying of hunger. Moreover, the U.S. has caused today's disaster on our soil. They invaded our country and took thousands of lives from our people. They have to compensate, not us. We have not attacked the U.S.
Some Afghan experts also see Biden's decision as illegal and a big harm to the economy of Afghanistan.
There are a couple of reasons that question Biden's order. First, Afghans were not involved in the 9/11 attack. Most of the attackers were Saudi. Second, Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan. Third, it is a one-sided and selfish decision made by the U.S. president. The money could support the Afghan monetary system and help stabilize our economy.
Following the Taliban takeover of the country, international funding to the Afghan people were cut off and billions of dollars in Afghan assets were frozen by the U.S. The U.S. President Joe Biden keeps half of Afghanistan's frozen assets for 9/11 victims, while millions in Afghanistan are on the brink of starvation. Afghans are blaming the U.S. for a looming catastrophe in their country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Such a busy bazaar, as if all the people are here. You might ask yourself why I have come to this bazaar. Indeed, I am here to buy some souvenirs for my friends. Tonight, I'm going to take a trip to Yazd to visit my friends there. Also, the day after, I have plans to visit the ancient village of Kharonagh. Kharonagh village dates back to 4,500 years ago, and is surely a spectacular place to visit. The historical village of Kharonagh is located in Yazd province, 70 kilometers to Ardekan County. In this region, there are iron ore, zinc, and granite mines. There is also a protected area in this region which is home to animals like wild goat, goat, sheep, mufflon, wildcat, caracal, and cheetah. Kharonagh, which used to be called Khuranagh in the past, means the place where the sun rises or the place where the sun is born. Kharonagh village has placed one of the large adobe structures of Iran in itself. This village has two parts. The new part in which over 500 people live and the old part or the castle of Kharonagh, which is damaged and empty. Some of the must-see landmarks of this village include Kharonagh Castle, the historical bath of Kharonagh, Kharonagh Caravan Sarai, Kharonagh Mosque and Hosseiniye, as well as the shaking minaret of Kharonagh. I am now in Kharonagh village. This village is ancient, and I'm so excited to see it. Kharonagh village dates back to the Sassanid era. This village used to be a place for taking rest by merchants and travelers. Let's look around the village together. I am now at Kharonagh Castle. This castle dates back to the Sassanid era. Well, this castle is surrounded by deep moats. These moats were used as a way to protect the residents of the castle against enemy forces. Six guard towers are attached to the body of the castle. There are 80 houses in this castle. In most villages of the Yazd city, you see nothing but adobe and mud. Oh, I'm so thirsty. My flask has run out of water. What a scent! The smell of wet earth is very pleasant. I'm crazy about this scent. Kharonagh village, like the city of Isfahan, has a structure called Shaking Minaret or Minar Jumban, which shakes. This minaret also dates back to the Sassanid era. Its height is 15 meters. The Shaking Minaret of Kharonagh used to have three floors. Its top floor used for watching and lighting. It used to have a wooden structure on its top, which had been tilted because of earthquakes and wind blow. So the locals of Kharonak had detached it and brought it down. To be honest, I don't dare to get close to it. I am now at the center of Kharonak Castle. Here, there is the Kharonak Jame Mosque. This mosque dates back to the 8th to 10th century AH. Adobe and mud are the main materials used for building this mosque. Though, as it shows, bricks are also used in the minarets and facade of the mosque. It's very beautiful and spectacular. Actually, Kharonak has many must-see places to visit, and unfortunately, I can't describe them all for you. Just tell you one thing. Don't miss the night sky of this region if you happen to visit here. The stars in this region are so near to you that you feel you can touch them all with your hands. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavita Khwai. Demonstrators in Kabul have condemned President Joe Biden's order freeing up around $3.1 billion in Afghan assets held in the U.S. for families of America's 9/11 victims, saying that the money belongs to Afghans. Some of this money has been termed, in terms of the U.S. keeping it, as a form of theft. Others are saying that this money should be given to Afghans. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the justification or lack of it from the U.S. on allocating this money to victims of 9/11, and not Afghans who are facing a humanitarian, not to mention an economic crisis of epic proportions in their country. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Jim Kavanaugh joining us. He's a writer and blogger at The Polemicist from New York. Also joining us, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Brian Terrell, let me first start with you. You know, this has been blasted all over the place, especially in social media, about the U.S. decision or the decision by Joe Biden to do this. What is your take on the way that the U.S. went about, the thinking that it went about to make this decision? Because obviously we're looking at the situation in Afghanistan and what the Afghans are dealing with.
Well, it's... It is theft, and it's unspeakably cruel at a time like this, at a time this winter. And it's what's been happening these more than 20 years. Rather than sanctions, the United States ought to be paying reparations if there's any justice. Usually a country that carries on a war of aggression and loses, it has to pay up. And the U.S. should have no say about how that money is to be used. The average age, the median age in Afghanistan now is a few months over 18 years. So more than half the people in Afghanistan were not alive on 9/11. They do not owe any debt to the people who died on that horrible occasion here in the United States on 9/11/2001. And most Afghans didn't know about the events of 9/11 until the bombs started dropping and the U.S. soldiers occupied. The U.S. supposedly already spent more money on the reconstruction of Afghanistan, and this is from the government's own inspector general, than the entire Marshall Plan that rebuilt Western Europe after World War II. And I visited Afghanistan. I was there, I think, seven times between 2010 and 2019. And over those years, while there's billions of dollars were being spent on reconstruction, going to U.S. Contractors, going to Afghan oligarchs, I just saw the city, the infrastructure of the city, just decay. With every visit, the city of Kabul was more insecure, was dirtier, was
that's interesting.
Yeah, and so it's 300 million dollars a day spent on the war, not on the reconstruction, but on the war going in Afghanistan.
Right.
And what these people, the people in Afghanistan, are victims.
You know, that's a good point that I didn't think of, which I will address to you, Jim Cavanaugh, if I can. So our guest there, Brian Terrell, talks about how he has visited Afghanistan. All the money did not show itself on the ground where it should. I'm guessing from schools to hospitals to basic infrastructure, perhaps. And then now you have this incident happen in which you have the U.S. taking half of that money, which amounts to about $3.1 billion, where you have no money circulating in the country. Millions are on the brink of starvation. How did Joe Biden think that this is going to help Afghanistan and to solve its crisis?
Well, he doesn't care whether it's going to help Afghanistan solve its crisis. This is a political stunt for the American political theater. And, you know, it plays well. We're taking care of the families of the 9/11 victims. Look, I lived a half a mile from the Twin Towers on 9/11. You know, I'm all for helping the 9/11 families. The United States doesn't have to take money from Afghanistan to do that. No Afghans were involved in 9/11, even according to the official story. The plot was hatched in Hamburg, Germany. So, you know, to make the Afghans pay for this now, after 20 years of war, in which at least 45,000, 46,000, probably 50,000 more Afghan civilians were killed, you know, this is kind of a gratuitous joke to say the Afghans owe us money for 9/11. And it is a kind of gratuitous cruelty. As Brian said, you know, the money that was poured into Afghanistan didn't help real social development of the Afghan people. It went to the oligarchs and the contractors and the weapons manufacturers. And what's happened, and you know, there was a crisis, an economic and social crisis in Afghanistan before the United States pulled out. So now they're going to make the Afghan people pay essentially this ridiculous, as Brian said, idea that the Americans go in and make war in a country for 20 years, kill 50,000 civilians, and then say, oh, you got to pay us for that. This is ridiculous. You know, it's kind of absurd. You know, when the United States defeated Nazi Germany, they didn't say, Germans, you have to, they tried that in Versailles, didn't work very well, you have to pay us. They poured money into the country. And so, you know, they had, not only are they taking this money, but they're imposing sanctions on the government. They just want to punish the Taliban for defeating them. And Biden wants to make political capital in the United States with, look what I'm doing. I'm taking this money from the, you know, the dirty Taliban to give to good American families who suffered from 9/11. And it's really, unfortunately, it's going to work well in the American theater, I think.
Well, let me ask you, if I can, I don't know if you can answer this, Brian Terrell, but talk about this decision to give the money, half of it, to the 9/11 victims, and whether it's justified or not. One source, and I'm not too sure, I can't say it's authentic or not, but I'm wondering if you have an idea, said that 9/11 families have been supported financially for 20 years by states, nonprofits, and for this move, it's not right to take away from the mouths of starving Afghan and to give these 9/11 families more money. Again, as our guest there said, there's nothing wrong with giving 9/11 family members money. So I'm wondering if this was indeed something that happened where they were taken care of by states and nonprofits, and whether the decision, did it run for a second in the U.S. mind that 15 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia and we should go be asking money from them?
Yeah, it's. I do know some people who were victims of 9/11 who don't feel like they've been compensated enough, and I don't know if they could be. But it's unclear whether this money, just as the half of the money that's going to be supposedly going to help the Afghans, whether it's going to get there or not, and also it's questionable whether this money that's been allocated for the families of the 9/11 victims, whether they're going to get it. And I think about all this money that's been spent. If the United States truly had rebuilt the infrastructure of Afghanistan, if they had actually built the hospitals that the people of the United States were billed for, that never existed, where the ground was never broken, if they had built the schools that they said that they built, and that so many Americans feel so proud of ourselves for building, if they had done that, Afghanistan would be a very secure place now, and the region would be much more secure. So this is all, you know, we're really making the world much more dangerous. And I'm glad people are out on the street in Kabul. And I'm tomorrow in many American cities, there's going to be people at American peace movement. People are going to be at federal buildings and other government facilities demanding that this. Decision be reversed. Sure. And people will be calling the White House, and I really hope that we will rise to that occasion and make these demands.
Well, talk about Afghans. Jim Kavanaugh, one of the Afghans out on the streets, said this, and I'm quoting him. Of course, it's been translated. I don't think the U.S. has the right to use Afghanistan's money to compensate 9/11 victims. The U.S. had no reason when it attacked us, but a lot of people died in the past 20 years. So it's the U.S. that should compensate us, and they should not spend our money. Does he have a point?
Oh, yes. Look, even Karzai, the American installed president of Afghanistan, said this was an atrocity. You know, again, it's at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed for something the Afghans didn't do. And so they've, you know, paid dearly for whatever imaginary crimes the United States wanted to, you know, blame on them rather than the Saudis or the German government, which, you know, harbored Mohammed Atta. So, you know, the idea that now what we have to do is impose sanctions and take away the assets, the currency, the gold of the Afghan government to compensate ourselves for what we've done to the people of Afghanistan, it's certainly, you know, if you could find a better way for the United States to guarantee that Afghanistan is not going to be friendly to it. And guess where it's going to turn? It's not going to turn to the United States, it's going to turn to China for help and assistance, and then they'll be whining about that. So it's a very silly notion in terms of even the geopolitical intelligence of the United States. But it's also, as I say, gratuitously cruel, and it's done for Joe Biden to score political points, which he will score. And, you know, because the Republicans and his opponents would attack him if they gave the money to the Afghan government Afghan people who deserve to have it.
That's unfortunate to look at it that way, but yeah. Well, Brian Terrell, you said that a lot of the population in Afghanistan is, I think, 18 years old. I'm not too sure what percentage you used.
It's the median age is 18.
18, okay. I'm going to build on that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to build on that and come at you using that stat, along with how overall you're looking at about, based on what we have, 24 million people who are suffering from acute hunger. That's 60% of the population, not to mention the drought, not to mention the fact that there's been recently a measles outbreak. So obviously the humanitarian aspect and the economic situation along with this is very dire. Add to that the 18-year-old average age. It sounds like this is perfect breeding ground for terrorists to exploit, which is what we have present currently in Afghanistan in terms of Al-Qaeda presence there with Khorasan. So has the U.S. thought how this can turn out to be a national security threat, maybe towards the U.S., since the U.S. president has decided to withhold this money and give it to 9/11 victims?
Well, I don't think it's in the interest of the arms manufacturers that there be, in the words of the CEO of Raytheon Technologies, that peace is not going to break out anytime soon, as he assured the investors when Biden pretended he was going to stop arming the Saudis. So they don't want peace to break out. General McChrystal, when he was the head of U.S. forces and NATO forces in Afghanistan under President Obama, was interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine, and he said that with every innocent Afghan who's killed, we create 10 new enemies. So we see that metric on July 29th of this last year, the Ahmadi family who were killed by a drone strike, 10 people killed, 100 new enemies by General McChrystal's count were created that day. And if
100 what? I'm sorry.
100 new enemies.
Right.
For everyone you kill, any innocent person, the United States creates 10 new enemies for itself. So that's good news if your investments are in Raytheon and in Boeing and in these other arms manufacturers. This is what President Eisenhower warned about in the military-industrial complex back in 1960, the fear that the United States is going to be not making weapons so it can fight wars, but making wars so it can sell weapons. I think we've really come to that, and it's just a harsh reality that a peaceful, prosperous Afghanistan that had fair and honest dealings with its neighbors, and its neighbors include Iran and include China and Pakistan. Peace breaking out in Afghanistan would be bad news for the U.S. economy. And so it's when things are so predictable, as you put it, that this is going to be a more breeding ground for more terror. Of course,
that's what happened in Iraq.
Yeah, it, of course it will be. And if something is that clear, so much to be inevitable, you have to suspect then that it's intentional. And on one level, this really is intentional.
This gratuitous
cruelty is there's a purpose behind it.
Sure. Okay. Well, Jim Kamada, do you agree with that? Which is, if true, that is just, you know. I'm not too sure what words to describe, because we're looking at a country that has been a victim for decades now. And it's just beyond words. And we here in Iran obviously see that, not only because of the close proximity that we have in terms of a neighbor, but also because of the influx of refugees that come into Iran, escaping what has happened there for the past decades. But do you think that is a train of thought that the U.S. perhaps has? And as our guest there mentioned, perhaps the arms manufacturers smiling at the fact that you have an Afghanistan that's in tatters.
Not only arms manufacturers, but, you know, the great geopolitical strategist whose idea was, you know, foment jihadi groups in the Caucasus, in the south of the old Soviet Union. Now foment jihadi groups right next to Iran. You know, they know what's going to happen. They're not that stupid. They look that stupid, but there are people involved in this who know what's going, the inevitable results of this. They're going to create more enemies. You're going to drive people into the hands of ISIS, which is already in Afghanistan, has a presence, and other groups like that that have a presence in Afghanistan. From their point of view, not only is it the permanent war, you know, as Orwell and Julian Assange said, the point of the war isn't to end the war. The point of the war is to keep it going forever as this constant stream of profits to the arms manufacturers. But it's also a constant stream of now tension and aggravation and diversion for the countries around Afghanistan that now have to, deal with those problems. And that's Iran, it's Russia, etc. So they want that tension there, and they want the arms, and they want the chaos. Really, this is what the United States has been doing for the last 20 years: is, you know, fomenting chaos.
Well, taking a look at the act itself. Brian Terrell, it's basically, I was curious as to see the figure $10 billion also thrown in as to the real figure here held by the central bank, which is set once this is held, then the banks within Afghanistan, where they're starving for cash, and it's going to cause Afghan businesses and then to suffer because they don't have the money to then pay out, for example, to the citizens or to business, for example, owners. And, of course, then the access to this money is going to be withheld. And, therefore, you have an economy which, as shattered as it was, is going to just basically have the wind knocked out of it. So, this chain of events, is there's no way escaping it. Puts into question the U.S. announcement by Joe Biden that we don't want the Taliban to have access to this money. But it sounds like there's a revenge taking place against the nation of Afghanistan and its people.
These sanctions are not hurting the Taliban. In fact, they are making the Taliban stronger by as we mentioned the demonstrations in Kabul and the hatred toward the United States for this outrageous act. I also had the opportunity to visit Iraq in 1998 during the sanctions there, and visited the hospitals and the schools, and the sanctions against that country were not hurting the upper crust, the cadres that were running the country. It was hurting the common people. This is something that charity is all very fine, and I think for people who are hungry, if some people do end up getting some food out of this. $3 billion that they're getting. I hope it saves some lives. But what's demanded is justice. I mean, this is not an act of charity for someone to steal someone's food and then give them a few crumbs. It's not our money. And if the Taliban is not to be trusted. The United States trusted a very, very corrupt government, a narco republic, it's been called, that it put in place and supported with tons of cash for 20 years. Taliban is not going to be any worse. It isn't our money to even we shouldn't even be thinking about it. It shouldn't be something that U.S. has any say whatsoever. It's a crime.
Well, Jim Kavanaugh, I'm wondering how the Taliban is going to. Position itself when it comes to the U.S. You have the spokesman for the Taliban condemning the U.S. for stealing the property of Afghan people, as he stated, posting on social media that the theft of the frozen assets shows the U.S. has degraded to the lowest level in human nature. What kind of reactions will we see from the Taliban? I'm guessing, first of all, that Afghans are going to really rally perhaps behind the Taliban because, in essence, they're seeing this face of the U.S. So that's one of the outcomes here. But regarding the Taliban, what can we see from them?
Well, they'll certainly rally against the United States. And briefly, at least in the short run, they'll rally around the Taliban government. the Taliban are in a difficult position, and they're economically weak, and they're going to need help. I think what you're going to see from the Taliban, as I suggested, is they're going to have to turn to other people who are capable and willing to help them, you know, in a non-cruel way, in a just respectful, bilateral way. So that's likely to be the neighbors, Iran, Russia, China, Pakistan, you know, and these are the places that they're going to have to look for help. In terms of the Taliban is a governing party that they have to find some help for themselves. So that's what they're likely to do. Politically on the ground, it's going to be anti-American, pro-Taliban. If the Taliban can succeed in getting help from other countries, they will definitely cement their position politically in relation to the masses in Afghanistan. So that's what we're going to see that playing out over the next few months, probably. And because it's an emergency, and somebody, they have to get something from somebody. And, there aren't 100 actors that can save them. There are, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 in the world.
Okay, unfortunately, I'm only left with about 30 seconds to give to you, Brian Terrell, as the last question here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to go after American bashing here, but I'm looking at a social media post where it says, I can't remember the last time so many people of such vastly different worldviews were so united over a U.S. policy decision on Afghanistan in this case. Do you agree?
I haven't heard that. I'm glad to hear it. I hope that there is universal disdain and protest over this. That truly can't stand. And we are, and the urgency of the situation is, the winters are very, very cold in Afghanistan, and there will be many, many deaths just in the next hours, the next days. This is a matter of utmost urgency.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist from Molloy, Iowa. Thank you so much. Jim Cavanaugh, thank you for your contribution, writer and blogger, the polemicist from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikaveh Tahweh, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shoma dar in qarn mo'jiza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, also shaped all our tomorrows. This program is about the life and times, the biographical account of Imam Khomeini. May God bless him and may his soul rest in peace. The leader, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution here in Iran. And, of course, we are going through the second phase of the life and times of Imam Khomeini, and this is in regard to his exile back in 1963. And with me in the studio to discuss that very phase is Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is from the Holy Seminaries of Qum, a very renowned scholar. Salam, hello, and welcome, Sayyidina. And thank you very much for giving us your valuable time today.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great. Sayyidina, we were at that point discussing about some of the great characteristics and virtues of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his and rest his soul. We were talking about the fact that he was very determined to deal with the situation here in Iran, because certainly in terms of the oppression from the Pahlavi regime. And we're now talking about, of course, Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza's father, who was installed since the 1920s, as you mentioned before. And, of course, he was trying to promote an agenda which was very similar to that of Ataturk we discussed in Turkey, where he was trying to secularize Iran and remove religion from the people. But he was doing it in such a way that there was a considerable oppression of the clergy in particular. So we moved to the 60s, and we were mentioning about the fact that since the time of Mossadegh, since in 1953, where Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani's movement in terms of nationalizing the oil industry, about trying to make it a republic or an Islamic republic, but the movement didn't last. It was the coup d'etat done by the CIA, by the Americans, established the son of Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza Pahlavi, as the ultimate and king of kings, we can say, of the region, not only of Iran, but of the entire Middle East. And of course, they had, through him, strengthened their relations with the Zionist regime, because we know that round about this time, of course, you know, the Arabs were having their Yom Kippur War, as they called it, with Egypt. And of course, Iran was helping the Zionist regime at that time through the Raza Shah Pahlavi. And of course, Imam Khomeini spoke out about that. I mean, he certainly was, you know, these were the things that he was highlighting to the public, that, you know, here we are supporting the very enemy of Islam in the heartland of the region. So we're now onto the second phase where, you know, the Shah has, you know, after that very powerful speech that he gave in the Fezia, the Hawza here in Qum, and, you know, the soldiers went in and, you know, we know of the atrocities that were then committed in the Hawza Fezia, where, you know, clergy were literally thrown off the rooftops and were martyred. And, you know, the whole Hawza Fezia was ransacked by the soldiers. And, of course, as you see, within a couple of days, Imam Khomeini was sent out of Iran. So I'd like you to speak now a bit about the exile, about this very important phase of Imam Khomeini's life, especially the 14 years in Najaf, where he was participating in the Grand Hawza there, giving lectures and seminars on his own right, because we now discuss the fact that he was also a Marja'i Taqlid as well. So could you enlighten us further as to what that phase of his life was about and how important it was in shaping future events?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In fact, the events of Fezia, which were pertaining to Imam's initial removal from Qum, because he didn't right from the outset be removed from Qum and Iran. He was in fact taken out of Qum
right. And
passed from pillar to post to different prisons and things
right.
in
Iran. Okay, so there was the prison
prison imprisonment and people's revolts and
sure. People's
want for him to be released and so on.
Yes,
I mean, after 19 days after the events of Ashura, which was on the 6th of June,
yes,
which is known as the